Good evening and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and Wally Derleth is at our phones tonight, and we ask that when you call in tonight, you please be patient, as he is our only volunteer here tonight, as we are still trying to manage safe social distancing practices here, keeping our volunteers safe during this COVID crisis in America. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends in the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997. He has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years, and he's also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he's authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, welcome back again.
Hey, Bill, it's good to finally be thawed out and warmed up. I feel human again.
Almost.
and I don't feel like Olaf the snowman.
I feel like I'm in one of those sci-fi movies where the planet rotates and it gets really cold and then really hot, because it's 76 out there this afternoon.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, and last week we were at, what, -7 on one day? Wind chills and stuff like that.
Exactly a week ago today in the morning was 1 degrees in Nacogdoches. I'm sure colder here.
Yeah, and that's Texas.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to see 1 degree in Texas.
No, I was on a national call with several other states, Wyoming, Montana, North Dakota, et cetera. They were pretty much laughing. And I said, we're not used to 1 degree. We're used to 101 degrees.
Yeah.
So we're set up for the hot stuff, not this cold Arctic stuff. So
I posted on my never fear. In 6 months from now, we'll be griping about the heat. You know,
that's right. So, that's right.
This is the South. We do it all here.
Right.
Well, Cliff, you are our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and we're inviting callers to call in tonight and ask you questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Also, any photos that you would like Cliff to identify during the show, you can send them to W. Beckett. That's WBECKETT. W. Beckett at lsus.edu. And we will pass them on to Cliff, and he will try to identify them for the next show of Bird Calls. And Cliff, at the end of every show, you do a conservation tip, and can you refresh our memories?
Yeah, we talked about reusable plastics. In the past, we've talked about recycling. That's one step. But another is to reduce and reuse. So we talked about reusing things like plastic water bottles, trying to go from using those to bottles that you can refill instead of a plastic straw. And that's a big change I've made recently. I quit using plastic straws. I bought some metal straws. They're really easy to clean and they work great. And boy, when you slurp up some cold drink, it's even colder in that metal straw. So I like that. Although, didn't we just talk about it was nice to thaw out a minute ago?
Yeah.
And then we talked about other things like reusing, instead of using plastic grocery bags, do reusable cloth grocery bags. And I've been doing that for a long time. My wife's really good at it too. We keep a batch of them in our vehicle. And I can't tell you how many times I've walked halfway through the parking lot going to get groceries and I have to turn around and go back and get them. No big deal. I've done that with masks during the pandemic. You know, I forget to wear the mask, go get it. Same thing with the cloth grocery bags, but I feel better reusing things instead of just adding it. You know, these plastic bags you get at the grocery store, just when you start thinking about it, it's good for one use. And then what do you do with it? I know people say, well, then I use it for, you know, putting paper in or poopy bag for the pets or whatever. But I just really am sold on using the cloth grocery bags. And they have some that are, of course, padded, insulated, so for ice cream, milk, etc. So I really like doing the reusable items. So we talked about that as being a way we can help birds. So think about that next time you're throwing away your plastic. See if there's some that you can reuse, like the ones we just mentioned.
All right, there you go. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And Joe from Longview, we're going to get to you in a moment. But first, we have our profile species. And Cliff, what do you got for us this month?
This evening, we're profiling the pied-billed grebe. Let me say that again, the pied-billed grebe. And we have two different vocalizations to play. So let's dive in and listen to example one here. That's the so-called greeting call of the pied-billed grebe. Sounds like a lot of giggling laughter. So now let's listen to example two of the pied-billed grebe. And this one is typically heard during the breeding season and sounds like mournful coos. The word pied, P-I-E-D, means several things, but for this bird, it's a reference to the black and white coloration of the adult's bill during the breeding season. In winter, like right now, that bill turns a unicolored yellowish tan. This species of grebe looks like a tiny brown duck floating on ponds and lakes. He's smaller than the smallest ducks in the U.S., like the bufflehead and the ruddy duck. Grebes have lobed toes, not webbed feet like a duck. A lobed toe, L-O-B-E-D, a lobed toe means each toe independently has a large flap of skin that helps push water while the bird swims and dives. Grebes have stubby tails and look rather tailless. One of this grebe's most popular colloquial name is hell diver, and it got this name probably from anglers in boats who'd watch a grebe dive underwater, seemingly never coming back up for air. Where did it go? Well, it must have dove to hell, thus the name hell diver. But this bird will often reappear dozens of yards from where it first dove, and if scared, they will just barely pop up the top of their head and bill in order to refill their lungs with oxygen before diving and swimming off even farther away. Diving is done not only for foraging for food, but it's also useful when avoiding danger. This is our nation's most widespread species of grebe. It occurs in the entire lower 48, plus the southern half of Canada and a sliver of Alaska. Their nest is built atop emergent vegetation. And like loons, the tiny fledglings often hop on the parents' back for a piggyback ride for safety and warmth. My mother was German, and my siblings and I grew up knowing piggyback as hookypock. While taking off, grebes need a running start on water in order to achieve liftoff. There are several accounts in the literature of injured pied-billed grebes and other wetland birds like coots and rails found in parking lots or below metal barns. What happens is during migration, when these birds are migrating at night, especially during a storm, they see the reflection from lights on wet parking lots or wet rooftops, mistaking it during low visibility as a pond. These birds crash land, and if they've survived, the following morning, the water is never deep enough on a parking lot or farm field for the long running start they need to get aloft again. To see a photo of a pied-billed grebe snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now. We have lines open, 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. We got our first caller online, Cliff. So we're going to go to Joe from Longview. Joe, you're with Cliff. What's your question?
My question is this. Even before the big freeze, I noticed there were more robins than usual. And then after the freeze, I've noticed that it's mostly robins out there. There are some other birds, but not that many. Have we had a big die-off of other songbirds?
We put out a lot of seed over that cold snap, and we had a lot of birds. And, of course, the robin is not a seed eater. They like berries. They like arthropods and earthworms and such that they can find on the ground. So, yeah, there was a lot of robins before the storm and during the storm. This is as far south as many of them get in the winter. I'm sure they didn't realize that we were going to have several days of the ground not exposed. So that meant that was a problem for those seeking earthworms. But there's still a lot of berries, at least in my neighborhood, and including my yard. We still had holly, the non-native variety of holly. That was the last species they hit, and they hit it hard over this cold snap. So, yeah, robin numbers were high this winter. That's not unusual. We get it every winter, and sometimes it just lasts a few weeks. But I think we're in the middle of it, and we're going to start seeing their numbers go. But as far as bird deaths, Joe, there have been several accounts of dead birds that probably related to the cold. What happens is if you're not very fit, and birds, we usually determine fitness as those that can carry enough fat to get mm-hmm. them through these hard times when food's not available. But I've heard lots of reports of yellow-rumped warblers found dead, a smattering of other birds, including hermit thrush, American goldfinch, pine siskin. These are off the top of my head, but we're just starting to thaw out and read more about this. And there are a lot of critters and plants that died in this, but it didn't kill everything. So if you feed birds, you would have seen a lot of birds at your seed feeder, Joe, like we did. We had lots of red-winged blackbirds and common grackles. We had a new addition to our yard, which we were super excited about, a fox sparrow, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. So there are other things that you could do to feed birds to get them through this. But the one thing I learned the most out of this storm is that when the ground was covered, completely blanketed by 3 inches of first ice and sleet that was hard, and then snow on top of it, a lot of birds just didn't know what to do. And they couldn't do, the ones that are ground dwelling couldn't do what they need to do without exposed leaf litter and exposed ground and so forth. So I really noticed that the birds that just couldn't do their ground dwelling activities were really hit. But I didn't see any dead robins. I've seen them feasting on stuff. So let's hope for the best that the birds made it. So that's kind of a long answer, Joe, but thanks for the question.
It's good. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that does bring up a question that a couple of people posted on Facebook. One, Kermit Poling, our station manager, wrote and sent me a picture of blackbirds, red-winged blackbirds, swarming his bird feeder. And he said it sounded like a squeaky wheel convention. And he was kind of curious, why are they all of a sudden swarming it? And, I think the obvious answer is that there's food there.
There's food there. And that can be without the snowstorm. That's actually a species a lot of people that feed birds don't like, when the red-winged blackbirds come in, because they can overwhelm the feeder. There goes your price, your budget is just changed on providing all those mouths to feed. So I think if you feed a long time, you'd notice that you'd have lots of red-winged blackbirds and common grackles, and depending on where you live, other species that get in these huge numbers, and they're hungry. And so, it doesn't surprise me that Kermit had a lot of red-winged blackbirds. I, too, had, 25, 30 at a time was not unusual during the snowstorm.
And also I saw on Facebook somebody had posted saying that if you run out of bird seed, try peanut butter out there because they need fat, too. That's the way I might think about it. But, I'm not a bird. I don't know how to...
Right.
Birds handle peanut butter. So what is your thought on that?
Yeah, peanut butter is difficult to eat. So there are people that have, you can go online and look for recipes for what's called butter bark. Some people call it bark butter. There's a product by one of those names. And it's a mixture of a bunch of stuff, not just peanut butter, but it's got cornmeal, lard, oats, You can add all kinds of other things if you'd like, but those are pretty much the main ingredients, I think. And then you can buy specially made feeders that hold it, or you can just slap it on the tree where you have really rough bark where it can hold in the crevices. But once it starts getting up to temperatures like we have now, a lot of those ideas just start liquefying, and then the ants get active, and then you got ants. But when it was 1 degrees, it worked great. It stayed hard, maybe too hard. We noticed a lot of birds couldn't even get to it. It froze so quickly. But no, I wouldn't just put straight peanut butter. I would, again, go online and look up how to make some recipes that include peanut butter, cornmeal, lard, oats, etc. And again, butter bark or bark butter, you can find that online. And that works really well up north. If you have winters, you know, in Duluth where it's always super cold, or mostly super cold, versus down here, yeah, we're now in the 70s, so it's crazy.
Right.
So I wouldn't put it out when it's warm in the winter. I'd do it when it's super cold. Yeah.
I know. I also saw a friend of mine out there on social media post a picture of a whole bunch of robins in a tree next to her window, and of course the snow out there. And being from Ohio, we always knew that if you found a robin's nest, then winter was almost over.
Yeah.
Because they were the best predictors of whether winter was gone.
Yeah.
If you found an egg in the nest, you knew it was only a matter of days before it started warming up. And that was always our indication as kids. We would go out and look in our blue spruce and other trees where they like to nest, and try to find those robin nests just to see if all of this winter is over. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have lines open. And Gary from Dieball is on next. Gary, what's your question for Cliff?
Oh, thank you. You're doing a great job. Glad we made it through this.
Yeah.
Okay, I got a. I think it's a mockingbird issue. I got a cedar tree in this bush with these little bit bigger than a BB blackberries on.
Uh huh.
And this one bird does not let any bird on that tree.
Yeah.
Even on the ground.
Right.
Are they guarding the food, or are they guarding the nest?
No, they're guarding the food. That is important to them, to guard their cupboard, their refrigerator.
Even when it was cold.
Especially when it's cold, because he's not stupid. He's got to figure out that I'm going to have more of this cold weather. I need more of this food. I'm not sharing it.
He's about as big as a Coke can.
Yeah, he probably puffed up, too. He puffed up his down jacket and kept warm. People notice that, too. Birds looked fatter. They're not fatter. They can move their feathers out and trap in more heat, to just like we do with a jacket.
Right.
Yeah.
One more question.
Yeah.
I got this big pine tree in the front yard, and I seen a big, tall, beautiful pine tree. Anyway, I've been seeing a little woodpecker on it. I think it's a woodpecker. It's sitting there pecking the tree, and it ain't redhead. It's got a yellow look to it. But that's just a regular woodpecker, right?
Well, we have in the listing area, we have at least 8 species of woodpeckers.
Okay. I need some pictures.
Yeah, there's not any with a predominant yellow flavor to them. There is one that has yellow on the belly, but you can't usually see it.
This one looks like it was in the head, in the beak, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's hard to know what you saw description.
Do they travel through? Are these migrating? Or do they hang around here?
It depends on which of the 8 species you saw. Two of them are highly migratory, and the other 6 are resident, meaning year-round.
Okay.
So I can't answer that until we know what it was.
Right. I'll get a picture.
Yeah.
One more question. I'm very busy.
Okay.
Where are the buzzards? Where do they go? I hadn't seen them in a couple weeks or so.
I saw black vultures flying around on Tuesday when it warmed up to what was the high that day, in the teens or 20s.
Yeah, 18, 21.
Yeah, something crazy. And I was shocked because you know, any roadkill or dead animal was going to be hard as a rock and probably covered by, you know, the same 3 inches of ice and snow. So I don't think they fed that first couple of days. But I did see black vultures, and then I did see turkey vultures. But I think they, you know, they probably skipped some meals.
So they're roosting up somewhere?
Probably roosting up to stay warm. When you're a big bird like that and you get iced on, and they roost out in the open, they probably couldn't fly for a good bit because they've got ice on them, and they got to kind of shake that off and hopefully dry off.
It is crazy.
Yeah, okay, it is crazy.
So I don't worry about this bird in the...
Nope, he's doing what mockingbirds do. So, yeah, it's like saying, what do I do about my dog that's barking? That's just what dogs do.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
All right, thank you.
Doing a great job.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have lines open. And we go next to Don from Henderson. Don, you're on with Cliff. What's your question? Hello, Don?
Or maybe who?
Yeah, thank you.
Ah, there we go. Just stepped away.
Yes. Today was a bonanza of seeing birds today. What got me outside looking was I heard the red-shouldered hawk screeching, and I could tell just from the sound of it that they were having a confrontation with a red-tailed hawk. Which is what I verified, two against one, which seems to be the case. So my first question, I got two of them, is, you know, why do the red-tailed hawk looks much larger when they're seen in comparison to the red-shouldered, but they seem to come around and challenge the territory, and they don't stick around. So they're bigger than the red-shouldered, so how come they lose out?
Yeah, most of our red-tailed hawks are migratory. Not all of them. We have some that stick around and breed. But my guess is that those are wintering birds that don't have a tight, defined home range or territory versus the red-shouldered hawk, which stick around, and that's their home year-round. So I bet you it was home field advantage for the red-shouldered hawk versus the red-tail that really didn't care about getting pushed out and moved down the, you know, several blocks away was fine with him. So that's my guess on those two. But you're right, red-tail's a larger raptor, much bigger feet, and they don't terribly overlap in what they're eating. Red-shoulder with smaller feet are usually going after smaller stuff, and red-tail with larger feet typically going after larger food items. So there's some overlap, but it's not 100%.
Well, they sure didn't put out the welcome wagon. It was more like a war wagon.
Yeah.
And I've seen that before.
Yeah, yeah.
The other bird I saw was about a robin size or smaller, and it was about 60 yards away with binoculars. From the back, it had kind of a dark head, gray back, and then a darker tail, and it looked like there was a long beak, I mean, like an inch long or something, red or orange. And I'm not sure whether that was an optical illusion, and maybe it was just a robin. But is there anything out there with a reddish or orangish beak that's about a robin size or maybe less with a similar color?
I don't know. That's a toughie. I'm trying to rack my brain here and go through everything. I liked what you said about optical illusion. I think it probably was a robin, and maybe that yellowy pale bill looked a little funny in the light. So other than that, I can't think of what it could be. Don, so I think we're gonna need a photograph next time on that one.
No,
yeah,
didn't get it.
Okay. Yeah, cool. Well, all right, well, thank you, Don.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding birds or our avian world are welcome, and we do invite you to call in right now. And we do have lines open. We're going to go next to Jennifer from Leesville. Jennifer, what's your question tonight?
Hi. Well, I actually sent some pictures to Mr. Beckett because I saw something in the snow that I'd never seen before. When I first went to my window, I thought it was a woodpecker, but it didn't have a classical red head. It looked a little bit more feathery. And so I got some pictures, but, man, it was pecking all around the tree. I mean, it was just going to town pecking all around the tree. And so I actually sent some pictures.
Did we get those, Bill?
I was going to ask, Jennifer, when did you send those? Because I have not seen those come in.
Did you send them as a different name, maybe, Jennifer, name?
Yes, I did. I would really like not to give my email address on the air.
No, you don't have to give.
No,
we don't want your address, but are you with Jeff? We got some pictures from Jeff and David and Tim.
No. I mean, I just sent them not too long ago, like just a few minutes ago.
They haven't come in.
Yeah,
yet.
We haven't gotten those. Okay. Yeah.
I sent two different emails.
Okay.
Anyway, if they pop up later on during the program, if you get a chance to identify them, I'd love to see them.
Yeah,
let me just tell you, it was a little brown, but it had a distinctive pattern on its head. And it was loving whatever bugs it was finding on that tree.
Okay.
I mean, it was just going round and round and round and round and round that tree. And like I said, I thought it was a woodpecker, but it wasn't smooth.
Well,
so,
we'll get that after the show.
I mean, it wasn't as big as I would have thought a woodpecker would have been. It wasn't a huge bird at all. I have no idea what it was. I've never seen it before, but. Anyway, if you get the pictures, let me know.
We'll respond this week. We don't usually check email during the show.
Did
so.
I lose you?
Nope. We're here.
Yep. Can you hear me, Jennifer?
Hello?
Yeah. What happened? I don't know.
Okay. I'm going to hang up.
Okay. Thank you.
I can't hear you.
Okay.
Interesting.
Weird.
That's strange.
Okay.
Technology.
Well,
hate it.
What we'll do with Jennifer, if she can hear us, is we'll check email later. We don't do that during the show. We got many things going on. And then we'll respond within a week of seeing her email with her pictures. So I'm intrigued on what Jennifer took pictures of.
All right, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds in the avian world are welcome. And we have Robbie next from Shreveport. Robbie, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, I have a Harley Bush in front of my house, right in front of my screen, and which I'm literally 5 feet away from it. I could watch these birds feed. And last winter, I looked up a bird. The whole swarm of them came down and just feasted. And then they flew straight up in the air almost. And I looked up, and it was some sort of bird that lives high up in fir trees, like pine trees.
Yeah.
Okay, now this year, I saw this I believe it was a robin. He was tennis ball stomach size.
Okay.
Reddish. And he was alone in the tree. He was feasting on the berries, and he was going to town. And then I noticed he came back later with a friend, and he seemed to be living low to the ground. Well, then the birds that live up in the fir tree, about 20 of them came down and were feasting away, and those two fat birds came and chased them off.
Yeah.
And then the mockingbird got in the middle of the whole thing, and the fat birds weren't having any of that. And
yeah.
The mockingbird lost interest and left, and then those the birds from high up in the tree, it never came back.
I'm guessing that your birds high in the tree that you're talking about are probably cedar waxwings.
That's what they are. Yeah.
Yeah, and so cedar waxwing, robin, and mockingbird, and back to Gary's call earlier, they're all going to guard berries. When they find a berry bush, they're going to eat as much as they can. Then they got to wait, but they're going to guard while they're waiting. They know they need the next meal.
What he was doing, because he was sitting there not eating, because he was backed up to where his back was to my porch, like he was looking straight out in the yard.
Yeah.
Like a sentinel.
Right. Yep, and so we see this most with hummingbirds. People always comment about how hummingbirds are bullies and they protect a feeder, won't let anybody else get to the feeder, any other hummingbirds. And it's the same thing with in the winter with these berry bushes.
Nobody will get along.
Yeah, they don't get along. They're all fighting for the same food. It's Hunger Games. Think about the movie. It's Hunger Games and birds. Yeah.
But the thing was, I had two holly bushes. One was stripped weeks and weeks ago. And I don't know why they didn't strip the left-hand one. So the left-hand one just still got about 30% of the berries left. And I was also wondering why would birds start on one bush and then finish it and then move to the other one.
Yeah, I'm guessing they know about when those are ripe, maybe, or maybe it's taste, because I've noticed that our non-native holly is usually the last one to go versus our black cherry. It's a native. It's a Prunus in the genus Prunus. That one is usually first to go. And so that also tells me it's maybe not just ripeness, but it's what they prefer, flavor, getting the most bang out of their buck, etc. So it might be that they're eating all the really good home cooking first, the native stuff, and then they wait with the fast food that's, you know, been sitting there a while. That's just last resort.
Well, let me ask you this real quick. Like, say, take for instance the fat bird, the robins, I guess it was, I saw. How many berries could they eat in a day? What would have to, and especially when it was cold like it was?
Yeah, it depends on the berry. I've never read anything that answers that question. I don't know. But fruit goes through a bird very quickly. The usually about 20 minutes or so. So you'll see robins eating and pooping all pretty much the same time, because if they've been camping out for 30 minutes, those first berries have already gone through.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and you don't want to park your car. And my son learned this the hard way. He had his car, he's a 16-year-old new driver, and he's got a new used car, and boy, did it get just pulverized by American robins. Well, his sister or daughter is named Robin, so I teased him. I said, well, all the times you picked on your little sister named Robin, she got with her friends also named Robin, and they pooped all over your car. But it comes off. It does. People say, oh, it'll burn the paint off. Yeah, show me that happening. That's baloney.
Right.
People just don't want to put the elbow grease in it. But it was real easy at first while especially with the snow covered, protected the car, and then when it started melting, all the poop was really liquidy. That fruit goes really quick through the system of a what we call a frugivorous birds. Those are fruit eaters, and we've talked about the three biggies with this call: mockingbird, cedar waxwing, and American robin. They're not exclusively frugivores. They eat other stuff too. But
well, that was my next question.
Yeah.
You can tell me, get off the phone whenever. But I crumbled up when I saw the birds coming back and forth. I started crumbling up a couple slices of bread and threw it out there near the holly bushes, and they never touched it.
Yeah, bread, you know, we're used to feeding bread to the ducks at the city pond. They take it, but most of our backyard birds are just not going to do it. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think if you maybe put it into tiny shards like the size of, you know, grains of rice, maybe a bird could take it. But if you have the chunk out there that you know, is the size of a cornflake, they probably can't choke it down, and they don't really have that dexterity to make it smaller.
Kind of mash it up, maybe stick it in a bowl somewhere.
I wouldn't waste my time.
Yeah,
I mean, there's so many other things you can do that the bread
it's the heel of the bread. That's what I can
deal
with.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't like the heels either in our house. So, all right, Robbie, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call or any question regarding our avian world is welcome. And we go next to Frank from Avoyelles. Frank, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi. I live in an old farmhouse, country farmhouse, in the country, with a large wraparound front porch with open rafters. How can I keep the birds, mostly house sparrows, from nesting under the roof?
You're going to have to put up some chicken wire, small gauge wire, wherever you see them really concentrating their effort. You got to plug up those holes. You know, use wood, you can use hardware cloth, but it's a project. You can't really do it any other way. You've got the infrastructure, the architecture that they need, so you have to cap it. You have to kill that architecture, and you're going to have to get out there with hardware cloth and some scissors so you can cut it to size and a stapler, And you know, it's going to be a weekend project, but there you can't do it any other way, really.
Yeah, the artificial owls and snakes and all that don't work.
Yeah, you go spend your money on that. You'll see how long that lasts, about 12 seconds. Yeah,
okay.
That stuff does not work. It does not work. Without movement, the owl just looks like the gnome in the yard. It's got to have movement. So somebody came up with a plastic owl decoy where the head bobbles like a bobblehead. But if the wind's not blowing, it doesn't move. And I would think that after a while, the bird's like, hey, his head's moving, but he hadn't moved in 4 days. I think they figure it out. And there's no threat from something that's not moving.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
So unless you're the scarecrow from Wizard of Oz, you pretty much...
Yeah, there. That's a good one. He moves around a lot.
Well,
he
didn't want you to let him off the
that's
nail.
That's true.
You know, so. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now, and Karen from Longview, you are up, and what's your question for Cliff?
I had two questions. If they haven't been asked already tonight, I wasn't able to start listening right at 6. But one, a new birder, and so I'm wondering about what triggers, is it just the weather, or are there other things that trigger it when the birds that I've been seeing this winter, when they will start leaving? I've seen dark-eyed juncos and house finches as two or three others around my bird feeder. And then my other question was, it did seem that the birds were eating at the bird feeder much more the two or three days before the snowstorm. And I wondered, is their instinct, do they recognize that something's changing in the weather? I was just curious about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I'd question, how did you determine that? You'd have to keep really good records.
Okay.
Of how much seed, maybe poundage of seed, and then you'd have to correlate it with how many birds of which species came in, because 20 juncos are not eating the same volume or weight as 20 red-winged blackbirds or 20 common grackles. So there's a whole lot of variables in that, and I'd really question how you came up with that. I think birds do determine barometric pressure changes, but does that make them feed more? I mean, it probably can in certain times of year trigger movement, migration in some species. But your earlier question about triggers and migration in the junco, certainly the day length is a biggie. When our days get longer and our temperatures start to rise, those are good triggers for birds to move on north. So day length is a biggie. And so our juncos don't stay year-round with us. So for those that really like their backyard junco, they know, if you've done this a while, you know that they always leave in the spring. They do not summer with us. And I've always said that they're one of the smartest birds. They get out of the hot south when it gets so heated and humid and go up and see where juncos breed. And it's like a light jacket in the day and a sweater at night. It's just wonderful what the junco does. Thanks for the call, Karen. Appreciate that. And watch for birds to get out of here in the coming weeks, maybe even 2 months.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And boy, the calls are pouring in tonight. We've got Bo from Faraday, Louisiana. I hope I pronounced that town correctly. Bo, you're on with Cliff, and you can correct me.
You're quite correct. Thank you, Cliff, for taking my call. I have a lake house on Lake Concordia, which is near Faraday, Louisiana, in Concordia Parish, Louisiana. It's a lake about 6 or 7 miles long and a half a mile wide, part of the old Mississippi River, of course.
Okay.
And we have hundreds of cormorants.
Mm-hmm.
And they fly from one end of that lake, turn around, and fly the other end. If each of those cormorants eat one fish a day, I don't know how we're supplying enough food for those.
Yeah, that.
What's the eating habit of a cormorant?
That is a decades old question. It's been tested many, many times. There's papers published in the 70s, 80s, 90s. We keep seeing more publications that most of the fish they're eating are bait fish. So they're not going after game fish as much in volume. So they're really after bait fish. They're going to be eating stuff that, you know, everything's eating. So the thing with lakes they've found is that as long as the lake has it's healthy and there isn't drought, for example, that they can handle the pressure from cormorants and anglers alike. But no angler wants to see another boat next to him. And so they don't want any competition. They don't want another angler in the boat next to them, and they certainly don't want cormorants next to them either, or flying over. But angling is a crapshoot. You throw that bait out, you hope for the best, but we can't correlate fish numbers with cormorant numbers. It just hasn't worked in all the publications I've seen on it. So they get along fine, and I think they're here to stay. The cormorant was here longer than we were, that's for sure. And another thing we've done is we've created more inland water for cormorants. Your lake and most of the lakes in Texas, except for Caddo Lake, are all man-made, and certainly stock ponds are. But, you know, Lake Tuwakini, Lake Sam Rayburn, Lake Toledo Bend, these are all man-made. And they make these cormorants short stop where they probably historically went all the way to the Gulf Coast to overwinter. But they've got it good going part way, not the full way to the Gulf, to these inland waterways. Wright Patman up in Texarkana is another good one. There's hundreds of these inland bodies that we've created. So we've created this habitat, and the cormorants do fine. But again, anglers want to point fingers at too many other fishermen, including the cormorant, but there's just not the data to support that the cormorant's an issue.
But we don't know exactly what the daily consumption of a cormorant.
Yeah, we do. There's some papers. There's one by Thompson et al., I think. I don't have that in front of me. You can Google that, and it'll tell you. They collected cormorants and they looked in their stomachs, and they have, you can't do that crack of dawn. You got to let the cormorants feed during the morning, and so they know how much they're eating. And it was something like shad was the number one thing they were eating, and so by volume, by number, and sunfish is another big one, but they weren't eating the trophy fish, the game fish that we all want to catch. They were very little bass, crappie, and others. So you can Google that, Bo, and find that information online. Those publications are available.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and the phone lines are full up there, Cliff. So we are going to go to next to David from Austin. David, what's your question for Cliff?
Hello, Cliff.
Hello.
During the cold and extreme cold like we had, what do nocturnal owls do? For example, eastern screech owls, the great horned owl, and barred owls. I mean, they're usually active at night hunting, and that's the coldest time during a 24-hour period.
It is, and most of those you listed, a big portion of what they're eating are mammalian prey, and so those mammals have to get out as well. Rodents, skunks, opossums, all those kind of things are out and about, and they're available to these raptors. So the screech owl, it'll eat large insects. It probably didn't get many wood roaches during that cold snap, but there are certainly mice running around. They're frantically trying to, you know, get that caloric intake and get out there and feed. They can't take too many days off. But speaking of taking days off, you know, the owls can probably, if they're fit and have that fat layer, they can probably skip a day or two. I think it gets with birds, things get weird after about 4 days. That's a rule of thumb. I'm not really citing anything, But 3 or 4 days of not eating, most birds that have fat buildup can survive. And I would think a lot of those birds you listed would do just fine. So, yeah. So thanks for the call, David, on owls. I love to hear about owls.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we go next to, I'm not sure if these lines are crossed, but I think it's Josie from Shreveport. Josie, can you hear me?
If not Josie, who is this?
This is Bill, then. Bill, Bill from Centennial. You're on with Cliff.
Hello?
Yep. Go ahead.
Is this Bill?
Hello, Bill?
Yes. Yes, I've talked with you before, but it's been a while. But let me turn the radio down. Yes, you there?
Yep. Yes.
You there?
Yes, speak. Speak, Bill, or we're going to cut you off. All right, Bill's out of there.
I think he's got his phone on mute. Bill, go ahead and call back, and we will try to get you on in the next round. And Josie, you were on 321 instead of 320, but... you are here. Josie, can you hear me? Hello, Josie?
Who's on the call? If you're not Josie, who is this?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, who is this?
Hello.
Hello, Josie?
We've got numerous people that can't hear us, Bill.
Yeah, that's and I don't know why. So we're going to go with that and cut that off. Josie, go ahead and call us back. I'm going to clear all these lines. And in the meantime, Cliff, we do have some photos and audio that was submitted.
Yeah, and I don't know if the weather had anything to do with the phone, but we've never had this before. People all of a sudden can't hear us, so that's really weird. And I thought I'd mention that, you know, normally we're the second Tuesday of the month. I wanted to mention that we were bumped by the Trump impeachment on the second Tuesday of this month, and we were bumped by the snowstorm. So we barely squeezed this episode in at the tail end of February. We usually are not the last Tuesday of the month, but all those other things were obvious reasons to delay us.
The snowpocalypse. And, all right, we're going to go to our first audio that was submitted, and this was submitted by yours truly, Cliff Shackelford, and this is the mystery audio.
Oh. Wow. What critter is this? Let's listen.
Sounds like me when my alarm goes off in the morning.
We've covered this one before. A lot of people wonder what bird that is. That is not a bird. That is a squirrel. That's the gray squirrel, a.k.a. the cat squirrel. Crudely sounds like he's meowing. Some sound more kitty-like than others. But I recorded that myself, and I sent it to Bill. I wanted to play it because it's something that people hear in their backyard or in the woods, and it is not a bird, but it's somewhat bird-like, but that's the gray squirrel. So, yeah, what else you have for us, Bill?
All right, and this was submitted by Joel Rudolph, and he thought it was a whippoorwill, but we know differently.
Yeah. So Joel thought maybe whippoorwill, but then he was second-guessing himself and thought it was a chuckwill's widow, and the second one is correct. That's the chuckwill's widow, and I bet you he recorded that months ago. That bird is not back yet, hasn't been here since late summer, early fall. So listen for chuckwill's widows and whippoorwills. They'll start coming through next month.
And now we also have some photos that you can find on our Bird Calls page. The first up were submitted by Jeff Moffitt.
Yeah.
And can you, deal with these?
He sent some really decent pictures of a tiny little bird, head down, crawling up down the tree head first, downward, and this is a brown-headed nuthatch. And so I was really tickled that he got pictures of them because they're usually 80 feet up. It's a little tiny little bird, hard to see. So he's got pictures of them at eye level in a pine tree. Very good. Good job, Jeff.
All right. And let's go through these quick. We do have two callers back. Tim Hamer submitted these. They're not, you can't see all of the bird that you need to, but believe they're in a.
They're one of the finches, either house or purple finch. I can't really tell. They're not clear enough. Then the next picture, I'm really excited about. David Atkins sent in two pictures of fox sparrow. One of his pictures also it's been photobombed by a white-throated sparrow. But the fox sparrow I mentioned earlier was a new bird in my yard with the snowstorm, and it went from one individual to 28 in a matter of hours.
Wow.
A friend of mine in Huntington, well, he's our resident photographer for this show. He provides us with all our photographs, James Childress in Huntington. He had over 80 fox sparrows at his feeder during the snowstorm. And I interviewed a lot of people that run feeders, and I've lost track, but I'm up to 15 or 16 people in my area that ran feeders that have never had fox sparrow before. And boom, the snowstorm pushed them to our feeder. So that was a really fun new bird for us. And as soon as the snow went away, we had fox sparrow for maybe 6 or 7 days, and they're gone. So sad. Okay, next picture. Tell us about that.
All right, that was submitted by Chuck Ome, and he has been on our show before. He has a trail cam that we've gotten some fascinating footage of. And this is a pretty nice photo in flight, because I can't take one of them in flight.
My question is to Chuck, where did he take that whooping crane picture? Did he go down to the normal haunts on the Central Coast, like Rockport, Aransas area, or was this one of the reintroduced birds that they reintroduced whooping cranes into Louisiana, White River, White Lake area, and they have moved into Texas on occasion. So I wonder if he snapped that bird closer to him in the Houston area. It would be one of those reintroduced birds if that's the case. And then what else do you have? Is that our last picture? That is it,
except for the eagle cam, which we
wanted
to mention.
Louise called last episode back in January and told us about the eagle cam in Shreveport. She's a school teacher and in Shreveport. She told us about a Shreveport eagle cam. So Bill's got that on, and you can just Google it if you want. It's Metro Aviation Eagle Live Cam, and you can see what the eagles are up to. I've peeked at it several times in the day and even at night. It's amazing how dedicated adult eagles are, just sitting there and sitting there and sitting there and moving their head, and that's about it.
All right.
Incubating eggs.
We've got two callers online. We're going to go to Josie. Josie is back. Josie, can you hear me?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
So I was actually wondering, whenever the snowstorm happened, a lot of the birds came down and took cover under our porch. And I could, like, walk up to them. And they wouldn't fly away, but they do this very adorable hop. But I was wondering, you know, what do they do whenever it snows?
Yeah,
can they not fly?
Yeah, I think that a lot of birds were confused. A lot of birds that want to walk on the ground couldn't do so. They probably felt a little weird about walking on snow. A lot of birds dig in the leaf litter, on the bare ground, and the grass. They couldn't do all that. So I think a lot of birds were probably also just getting out of the cold wind, maybe, getting up against houses. We have an eave of our porch that hangs out enough that it stopped the snowfall in about a 4-foot width, 20, 30-foot long area. And the birds, it was the only exposed soil and leaf litter, and the fox sparrows, the chipping sparrows, the robins, the white-throated sparrows, they were all just fighting over that real estate, because it's what they all wanted. They wanted some bare ground. They wanted some leaf litter. They didn't want that white stuff. So it was pretty interesting to see that. So maybe that's what happened with your birds too, Josie.
So but they can still fly in the snow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the snow doesn't stop them. If you went over there and tried to grab one, you wouldn't have been able to pick them up. They would have flown away.
Well, then would the population be affected at all if they're all like fighting over very limited space?
Oh sure. It's definitely this is natural selection. This is Mother Nature. She is not fun and pretty. She can be very harsh. So we saw a little bit that with the storm. So thanks for the call, Josie. Appreciate it.
All right. Yes. And we do have to get to our last caller. Abigail from Kilgore is on. Cliff, what's your question for Cliff, Abigail?
Hi. I, like pretty much everyone else in East Texas, have been flooded with pine siskins all winter, including during the snow the last week. And I had actually stopped feeding them before the snow because I was noticing some salmonella cases. But I decided to feed them through the snow anyways. I figured that was worse. But in the last few days, as it's thawed, my neighbor and I are finding quite a few dead pine siskins, and they've really entirely disappeared from my feeders now that it's thawed. So did I kill them all off?
No. No.
What's up with the pine siskins?
No, I think, you know, it's hard to tell. You can't look at a bird and know if it's salmonella or cold-related, unfit bird that couldn't get through the cold. But another thing happens in February, and that's the elm trees start to bud. And a lot of our feeder birds, namely goldfinches and siskins, they abandon our feeders and go up into the trees of these elm trees. And they just tear up and chew on these buds. And so I'm guessing if you check your elm trees and if you know what these birds sound like, they didn't leave you. They just shifted what they're feeding on. Yeah. So great job feeding the birds, Abigail. Thank you for the call.
And we're going to try to get to Bill real quick. He's back from Centennial. I don't want to dump him yet. Bill, we need to have you state your question very quickly.
Okay. I was listening to Late Night, and it was a scientist turned evangelist and talking about a bird that migrates from Alaska to New Zealand, 7,000 miles in one flight, and I don't know the name of the bird. I'd like to look it up because I can't picture what size it would have to be.
Look up bristle-thighed curlew. It's a shorebird. Curlew is spelled C-U-R-L-E-W, and look up bristle-thighed curlew. I bet that's your bird.
All right. And Cliff, we've got to get to our conservation tip for this month. What do you have for us?
Yeah, we're going to talk about estate planning and doing it for the birds. If you love nature, think now about the positive impact you could have on protecting birds long after you pass from this earth. Don't assume your friends and family or heirs know what you might want to do with your estate, even if you don't consider it to be very large. Look into donating a portion of your assets to an organization that protects birds and their habitats. There are many good charitable organizations that do that. Websites like Charity Watch or great nonprofits measure a charity's effectiveness, meaning how much of its budget is specifically dedicated to its programs and mission versus overhead. Speaking of estate planning, and especially if you own land, sometimes the best solution is not to divide the property equally among the kids. Some of the heirs may have a strong interest in the land, some only a monetary interest in selling it, creating significant obstacles for the family wanting to keep the land intact. The most important message here, if you want your land to stay in the family and provide habitat for birds, discuss your desires now with your family and write that into your will. Consult a tax advisor or an estate planner today to discuss your wishes. Don't wait and make your kids guess your intentions. Do it for the birds.
All right, Cliff. Once again, I want to thank you for joining us and being our resident expert on ornithology.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and the state ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help with this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Bird Calls is produced by Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford with assistance from Wally Derleth. And the two sound files on tonight's program were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Andrew Spencer and Paul Marvin. And this month's bird photo was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in just a few hours at redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you would like us to identify, you can send it to me at wbeckett, that's W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsus.edu. And be sure to join us for our next installment of Bird Calls next month on Tuesday, March 9th at 6 p.m. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service. or public media service, I should say, from LSUS, and your voice of the community. We are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Camden Magnolia, KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and KTYK Overton Tyler Kilgore. Stay tuned, Radio Lab is coming up next.